welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is Now or Never, and that debt is fraud. Let me just kind of fly through the obligatories real quick, just because we've got Bill Cole, the founder of Peace Through Strength Institute, I believe, and I think I got that right. And I don't have his information on the website, but I will get that from him, and I will get that up there hopefully before the weekend. You know, I don't update the website until weekends anyway, so, and I'm probably behind right now, as usual, so I got to fire the IT guy again and then hire him back this weekend. Anywho, because that's me. So, let me just get through this. As we dive into what we're doing in content, we're trying to prove to you that we have to start holding everybody accountable, and hopefully this is empirical data that helps you understand in learning, praying, and acting, we can actually start invoking and demanding full compliance of the Constitution, because that's what it is about. And so when we start using petitions, we're making the actual legal constitutional argument of how our government is violating the Constitution, not just a little, you know, technicality. They are directly conflicting and violating the letter of the law in addition to the spirit of the law. So this is why it is so important that we hold people accountable. If you don't want to go into the next world without, you know, with blood on your hands, if you want to not go there with blood on your hands, we have to start standing up today, because that is our responsibility as citizens. So let's go to the interview. Okay, folks, we have Bill Cole. He's the founder of, if I get this right, Peace Through Strength Foundation?
Peace Through Strength Institute, that's correct.
Okay, it's the Institute. Okay, so Bill, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, how you kind of came to be the founder of this institute, and you know, the interest. I mean, did you come from a military background, blah blah blah? So what is important that the people need to know, that, you know, has created this leadership to imbue from you into the political arena? So go ahead, let the people know.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, GR. You know, I think I probably should start with, you know, I'm American. I grew up in Southwest Virginia, and I think that's important, because I have you know, conservative roots in my makeup, and I've been carrying those around my whole life. And you know, I'm 60 years old, so I've been it's been a long good life. You know, 3 years ago or 3.5 years ago, when the full-scale invasion broke out in Ukraine at the hand of Russia, I was probably like a typical American in that I thought, unfortunately, that Ukraine would fall in 3 days, and that was a very sad situation. I didn't have a lot of history or education and understanding a lot of the issues in that part of the world. I'd never been to Ukraine before. You know, I could find it on a map, but you know, I didn't have a lot of knowledge, and so I was pleased when it didn't fall, and Russia did not get their way, and the Ukrainians, you know, fought back mightily. And but look, you know, I'm the father of five sons, and I've got a busy life. I'm in software sales. I've been in software sales for 30 plus years. I live in California. I've been in California in the Silicon Valley for 25 plus years. And so I continued on with my life. And then I had the good fortune of meeting someone, a Ukrainian woman, who had been displaced. She and her family had been displaced, and she was living in Germany. And she and I became friends towards the end of 2022. She very quickly opened my eyes to a lot of the detail in what was happening in Ukraine. And so I started immersing myself in the problem. And we'll get up to July 2025 here real quick. So I decided to pitch in to figure out how can I, you know, support this effort. And so I immediately said, well, you know what, maybe I can advise a couple of companies, advise some companies that are trying, probably struggling, and see if I can help them get their feet on the ground here in the U.S. And so I was introduced to a couple of very interesting companies that are doing some incredible technology work in Kyiv, and I've been helping them for almost three years now. And but also wanted to get engaged in this unfortunate war. And my friend became a soldier. My friend is now a soldier for the armed forces of Ukraine. And so I decided I need to get to Ukraine. If I'm going to be involved, if I'm going to try and figure out ways to help this global problem, I need to discover the ground truth for myself. So I've been to Ukraine multiple times over the past 2.5 years or so. Each time I go to Ukraine, I go for about a month, continue to do my day job as best I can, and then spend time at a deep level as far as I can go. I've spent nights at the front. I've spent a lot of time with commanders. I've spent a lot of time with families, with my friends, just trying to really understand the dynamic of the war at the front, and also understand the dynamic in the interior in places like Kyiv and Odessa and Lviv. And each time I would go deep into Ukraine, I'd always come back with the concept of how can I get the United States to really see all of this with clear eyes, right? With clear eyes. And so I would go on these summit trips. It's called a summit. They call them the Ukrainian Action Summits. And it's put on by a couple of incredible groups. RASM is one of them. Nova Ukraine is another. And it's managed by a group called the American Coalition for Ukraine. And I signed up a couple years ago to go to one of these summits. The first summit I found myself at in the U.S. Congress was trying to decide whether to pass a rather large supplemental bill for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and another category. And so I went to the summit and got involved in advocating for Ukraine. I had on one of my trips to Ukraine, I was responsible for putting on a healthcare summit for 4 days in Kyiv, and I had the good fortune of bringing an American medic. This is a lady that's serving for Ukraine, serving at the front, bring her to speak at this healthcare summit. And she was part of a unit where six or seven of her colleagues were managing injuries, and so they were in Kyiv at various locations. And I was able to meet these, they were all men, I was able to meet these young men and take them to dinner. And when I was at dinner with them, all they could talk about were two men, Andrew Weber and Lance Lawrence. As it turns out, Andrew Weber and Lance Lawrence were killed in a firefight in July of 2023. Two Americans. Andrew was 40. Lance was 28. Lance is from Ohio. Andrew is from Washington State. And I heard their stories, heard their ending, their death. And that was in the fall of 2023. And so when I was attending this summit in 2024, April, I had the pleasure of meeting Lance's mom and Andrew's mom. It was very emotional because I had sort of put their stories in the back of my mind, and there I was at the summit, and here are these two amazing moms who were, you know, my age, around my age, and I thought, you know, the best way for me to get the ear of Congress is to walk the halls of Congress with these amazing women, these amazing moms, and see what I can unlock in regards to importance of the situation in Ukraine. Right. The next day after meeting Carla and Terry Lawrence, I was able to meet Allison McGowan, whose son Jericho was killed in late 23, like fall of 23. His body at that time, April 24, was still on the other side. So the four of us, Bill, Allison, Carla, and Terry, were able to go to a number of meetings in Congress, in the House, in the Senate. And one in particular that really hit me, and I think really made a difference. And maybe I should pause there and see if you have anything to interject or anything you want to ask me specifically.
So I actually do, but that's okay. I can let you finish this because I've got, you know, answery types of questions that, you know, like you're in Silicon Valley and some questions about that and other, you know, some personal questions, if you wouldn't mind answering them. But, no, go ahead and finish the story. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it worked. I think that putting Allison and Carla and Terry, especially in a meeting we have at the Speaker's office, with Speaker Mike Johnson's office, we were able to, you know, get their message to him. And 2 days later, the bill passed, and Mike gave an amazing speech. And in that speech, Mike said, "I do not want my son. I do not want my 18-year-old son who's going to attend the Naval Academy this fall. I do not want him participating in a war like this." And I knew at that moment in time, GR, that their stories had gotten to Mike. And I at that point in time, I built a level of faith in Mike and in our country that was something I didn't have before this summit. At the same time, you know, I recognize that the current administration... Let me see if I can be sort of, you know, political with this, or let me see if I can be politically correct with this. I knew we were making a huge mistake, not in funding the weapon need or in funding Ukraine. I knew that we didn't have a plan in place. I knew that we were not communicating a plan to Congress. We were not the White House was not communicating a crisp plan. You know, what's the timeline? How much is really needed? What's needed? Why is it needed? What's the end goal? None of that was conveyed in this bill, and so therefore the American public from April 24 forward just felt like they were being ripped off, and I understood that, and it was very concerning. I knew we had an election coming up in late 24, and I also recognized at the same time when President Trump was shot in July of 24. I knew then he was going to be our next president. And I remember having conversations with a lot of the supporters of Ukraine who had built good relationships with the Democratic Party and built good relationships with the White House. I remember saying, you know, we need to pivot. We really need to lean into the anger coming from MAGA, the anger coming from the Republican Party, the anger coming from Trump in regards to how we're handling Ukraine, how we're handling this war. If we don't lean into this, we're running risk of Ukraine not getting the support it needs to fight back. And so the election happened, and we all know how it happened, and we now have President Trump in place. So early January of this year, actually February, when that meeting happened between President Trump, Vice President Vance, and President Zelensky, those are the three main actors, right? I sort of had a different perspective on it. I think most of the Ukrainians and most Ukrainian supporters were aghast, and they were horrified by what they saw. And I saw something very different, which was I recognize fully that Ukraine, from its president on down, did not have a voice, did not have a way to communicate need or communicate truth or communicate a plan to someone like President Trump or someone like Vice President Vance or to anyone in Congress. And I realized if I don't do something, if I don't create a strong voice from an American perspective, we might stop our support for Ukraine and they might completely and totally fall. And so I made a very specific decision to start an institute based on really this thesis: bring the ground truth from the foreign conflict, in this case it's Ukraine, bring the ground truth to the table, combine that with American opinion, American perspective. So I've gone out and just the past 3 months I've done polls, I've created a plan to, you know, sort of a victory plan, and I've done that with the ground truth, and I've gone deep inside of Congress to try and figure out ways that we can effectively support Ukraine to where it means something to America. Because at the end of the day, it cannot be all about sympathy. It cannot be all about woe is Ukraine. It's got to be about what does this mean to American security interest? Because I know and I understand how the American people, you know, don't want to be involved in, you know, forever wars, right? I mean, we've seen enough of that with Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, you know, Iraq earlier. And so I recognize, and certainly recognize from the polling, that the American public is hungry to support Ukraine, but it needs to be done in the right way. And so that's why I started the Institute, and we can talk about some of the tactics and some of the successes that we're having now in July of 25. So I'll stop there.
Okay, great. So you're from Silicon Valley, or that's where you're operating out of for your profession, and that's a real liberal bastion.
Yeah, sure.
And so what kind of risk do you take with your employer, you know, people that live in that area? Because ideologues, and so have you found that the left is very supportive, more so than the right, as we look at left-right politics, or have they been far more critical of being involved in the war and supporting Ukraine? It's because that you're right there in the heart of a liberal bastion. So,
you know, it's a great question. First off, just where I am and who I am, you know, I don't get involved in a lot of the politics here, right? Thankfully, my employer is an incredible company run by incredible men and women. I will say my company is headquartered in Tel Aviv. My company is called Portelix. It's headquartered in Tel Aviv. And so whenever I do bring this up, and by the way, I don't talk about it a lot at work for obvious reasons, but they're very aware of my missions to Ukraine. They're incredibly supportive. And I think that you know, I'm grateful for that, right? And so we don't get into politics, we don't get into those kind of things. But we do recognize that war is awful, and I mean, obviously my colleagues that live in Israel understand that very well. And as a matter of fact, I have a lot of colleagues that are Ukrainian, and some are Russian as well, right? You know, they've made their way from Ukraine to Israel, from Russia to Israel. So I think I found myself in a pretty fortunate spot work-wise. Now, to answer your question in regards to, you know, the Democratic Party and the fact that we're 70%, 75% Democrat here in California, when I first started advocating for Ukraine in early 24, you know, I recognized that the customer was the Democratic Party, the customer was Joe Biden, that was the, you know, the White House. And that's who we really had to unlock, and certainly they had a little bit of a lead in the Senate at the time, and so it made perfect sense. And I think it made perfect sense for Ukrainian advocates early on to get their support from the Democratic Party and from mostly from Democrats, based on the fact that, hey, look, this is a moral position, this is a moral clarity position, you know, we have to support this country, you know, these people, 40, 45 million people in Eastern Europe, you know, this has to be a thing that we need to support on this planet, right? And certainly, I think that made a lot of sense. But look, we've come full circle now, and I will tell you that 80% of my conversations now in regards to trying to really plan out the next few months or the next year in regards to this this war and what does it mean to America, and we're going to get into that a little bit, what does this mean to America, are with Republicans. You know, I go back to what I said. I'm a conservative at heart. I'm a conservative in my feet. I understand conservative values. When I look at MAGA, I don't look at it as what a typical liberal looks at. You know, these are uneducated people. No, I don't look at that at all. I look at it in a very, very different way. And I would say 90% of my friends who I grew up with are full-on MAGA. And so I respect them highly, and I have a lot of conversations with them about Ukraine. Now, they are good debates, because I think we have done I think we've done Ukraine somewhat of a disservice, and so these are good debates. But my point is that here we are in July 25, and what I'm finding, GR, is that the Republicans are the ones they want to figure this out, because they see the evil in Russia, they see the evil in China, and they see that if we don't figure out a way to secure Ukraine, we're going to have multiple fronts. We might have a front in Europe, we might have a front in Taiwan, and God forbid we might have a front in our own backyard.
Right. Okay, and so
I think I'll just say that. I think that, and I think to lean into what you said, I do have a sense of disappointment right now, because I'm struggling with trying to get the Democrats to hear me out in regards to importance of planning the next phase of support for Ukraine, because it needs to be very methodical and very fine-penciled. If it's not, we will not get the support. They're not as responsive as Republicans are. So I think that's an interesting twist that maybe you didn't expect to talk to me about.
Well, so let me ask you this, because we talked before, and I do not like discussing the interview per se, because then we tend to not cover all the things I wanted to cover. But we did talk before about the constitutional approach, because, see, the conservative and the liberal, and especially the liberal, is not constitutional, and technically the conservative is neither, because both sides want to have, because I look at it, instead of changing the names from the immoral to the moral, you've got immoral control that want to basically, you know, indoctrinate your children to basically change their genders and all this stuff, DEI, all this garbage, indoctrination. And then there is the moral control that wants to have more of a moral background. And I support having moral education, those types of things. But I'm not in favor of government having its hands in things that it has no authority to do. Mm. It's like me coming to your house with a big, huge electrical cable and a water cable, and just connecting to you so that I can live off of your energy and off of your water in my house. I mean, I don't have the authority to do that.
Yes.
But that's what they're doing. And so in our conversation, because I want the people, because my audience knows where I am when it comes to, you know, world problems. The real world problem is basically getting everybody to become a part of this union and actually, you know, get into a constitutional framework. In other words, my plan for Crimea, my plan for Taiwan, Hong Kong, the Ukraine, the only way to do this is for the Trump administration or whatever the administration is to basically broadcast, we want to help you. But we can't just help you to, you know, to play with these tactics of, you know, keeping Putin out. Mm-hmm. We want to end Putin's involvement in your affairs. And the only way that can happen is if you, Ukraine, choose to become a state in the United States. So we're going to come over with all the force necessary to protect you so that you can have that election. And based on the outcome of that election, if you're going to become a part of the United States, then we will treat you as a territory, and we will basically establish forward bases there. Do you understand what that means, right? If Ukraine becomes a state in the United States, it basically puts us as a toll hold right there next to Putin.
Yeah.
And, see, that would scare the crap out of Putin, because once people actually realize that they could choose to not live by these regimes anymore, that they could actually move forward with their lives under this enlightened constitution and live a life of liberty and the rule of law.
Let me ask you a question. Yeah. Let me ask you a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
On your, your words, what's the difference between, I mean, that's a bridge, that's a pretty far bridge, I think, and I understand where you're coming from.
Right.
What's the difference between that and NATO? Like letting them into NATO. What's your thought there?
What's the difference? I heard NATO, but what was the difference between what?
Between having them become a state versus having them become a member of NATO.
So NATO is an organization that we have no constitutional authority to be dealing with. See, the United States Constitution allows states to become states in this union. We can admit states from anywhere into this union. But our federal government does not have, in the Constitution, any authority whatsoever to create a treaty to adjoin to the UN, to adjoin to NATO, to become a part of this international conglomerate. We don't have that authority.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay, so does that help?
It helps.
Okay.
But what I want to do, though, is that... I think all these things are, look, I think all these things are possible, right? I think that, who knows down the road politically and sort of constitutionally what a country like Ukraine ultimately becomes. But here's where my head is at. And I'm going to say my head, okay? Not my heart, not my soul, my head.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what I see very clearly, right? And this is why I've started this institute, because this is about ground truth. Ground truth is what's playing out in Ukraine right now is very different than what was playing out 3.5 years ago.
Okay.
Okay? When Putin invaded in 2022, I think he had every intention of using traditional methods, traditional weaponry, tanks, missiles, armored vehicles, infantry, to take all of Ukraine. I don't think he had a clue. Well, he had a little bit of a clue because he'd already been sort of investing in the area of drones, but not to the level that he fell into. So what he fell into was a war that very quickly, within months, became a drone war. I would say in 2022 it was 20% drones. And when I use percentages, when I use numbers, I'm talking about the level of kill at the front, whether it's a man or a woman, soldier, or if it's a vehicle, or if it's an artillery station, but the percentage of removement from the field of battle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now here we are in July 2025, and that number is pushing 90%. That front has gone from a zero line, maybe 4 to 5 kilometers back with operators or drones, to a 30 kilometer on each side front. And it's 1,000 plus kilometers wide, you know, long in length, right? So I've seen this firsthand. I've studied this extensively. I've worked with analysts. This is absolutely a full-on drone war where the kill zone is 90% drone ecosystem. And we're talking FPVs, we're talking ISRs, we're talking mid-range bombers, we're talking interceptors, we're talking anti-drone defense, we're talking fiber optic drones which avoid detection. We're talking having operators further back so they're not killed immediately. We're talking about things that change by the week. We're talking about AI being involved. It is absolutely 3 years now of World Series drone baseball, Dodgers versus Yankees, and they go out of there every day.
Right, and so let me ask you this. I get what I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Who benefits by prosecuting and continuing to prosecute this war? Who benefits?
So, who benefits?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you say prosecute...
Well, the defense industry, I mean, it's kind of easy. Most people that listen, and most of the libertarians and all, you know, war is a racket. I mean, Smedley Butler.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Yeah, I'll tell you exactly who benefits. You're exactly right. The military-industrial complex is benefiting. Right?
Okay.
They absolutely are benefiting, whether it's from the United States or from Europe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely benefiting. And certainly Putin and China are definitely benefiting. That's why they want this to go on and on and on.
Sure.
No,
absolutely.
But why do they really want it to go on and on and on? Because they are innovating at such a pace that within 1 year, they will have a fully automated drone army in the millions.
Yeah.
In the millions.
And so it's going to continue, right? And it's kind of like when we have problems in America, where do people actually fight their problems with government? I'll tell you where they don't fight their problems with government. They don't go into the legislative halls and demand their representative government stop doing what they're doing and get things right. What happens, because we've been indoctrinated into a judiciary form of government, that all things and that the judiciary is the final arbiter, when that is antithetical to our form of government and the framework that the framers gave us. So, you know, we're constantly being dragged into a battlefield where we're giving up walking in, because when you walk into a court, and I'll give you a good case in point, the Environmental Protection Agency is an assumed power that the federal government doesn't have. It's not enumerated. They just assume this. So regardless of whether it's a state environmental issue or a, you know, federal what have you, it always end up in a federal court. But the Constitution dictates that the federal court's jurisdiction is limited to all things arising under the Constitution. So why, when you go into the federal court over an issue that's not enumerated in the Constitution, you've right there, you've surrendered to play their game and hope that you'll get justice when you won't.
Yep.
So
yeah, look, I mean, you know, we can, and let's continue, because I mean, I think it's important to understand, you know, where I'm coming from. Look.
Yeah, I get it. So, but I want to look at this.
Biden made a huge mistake. Okay. Biden completely. I'll just be blunt. He had no idea what he was doing. I'm not even sure President Biden was President Biden. I said in 2021, this man has dementia. In 2021, I said this. Okay? So when it comes to Ukraine, he did not have a plan. He did not have a plan. His people didn't have a plan. Clearly, he was listening to Jake Sullivan. Jake Sullivan was whispering in his ear, just treat Ukraine like you do anything. It's a traditional war. You know, send them some weapons, send them some stockpile. Do this, do that, go to Congress, get some money, build some weapons here and there, slow drip them,
Okay,
now,
so
there were probably all kinds of noise going on with Hunter Biden and Ukraine and what have you, but the bottom line is he did not know how to beat Putin. He did not know how to deal with Putin at all whatsoever. Joe Biden was asked last summer during the NATO meetings, where he made the statement, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to give him the authority to hit Moscow? That's crazy. But the reality is, no, it's not. If that's what's going to get us to a point where we can end this war, then absolutely give them that authority.
Okay, so...
He had no idea what he was doing, right?
But
here's the problem. Here's the problem we have in July 25.
Mm-hmm.
July 25. The slow drip continues. The military-industrial complex is still controlling what goes to Ukraine and what doesn't go to Ukraine. And some of the things that we're sending them, yes, they need more patriots, but hey, man, if we don't do the deep analysis and if we don't say what is really needed to neutralize that front, because that's what's going to take.
Okay, so strategically, let me kind of cut through this. And
yeah.
What I want to do is kind of have you back because I'm literally out of time. But
yeah.
Strategically... What is the end goal? Ukraine sovereignty? Ukraine being able to stand on its own? Or is the end goal beating the crap out of Putin and bombing the crap out of Russia? Or, I mean, I just want to understand, what is it that the end goal is? Because if the end goal is really supporting Ukraine and supporting their sovereignty, then we can get there very quickly at very little cost and actually frustrate what Putin and China want to do. Because if we start doing the constitutional thing, then both China and Russia will have a whole bunch of states within their little conglomerate, you know, I'll just say corrupt enterprise, of people saying, we'll have another Tiananmen Square. People will actually see that they're not stuck under this regime. When actually the states break away, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Crimea, Ukraine, and on and on, as states, you know, become territories and move towards becoming a state in the Union, and we stop funding the UN and the rest of this cockamamie crap and actually focus on no longer building regimes but establishing sovereignty for all states and liberty and the rule of law throughout the world.
I think there's two paths that need to be, you know, traveled in parallel, right? One is the one you're describing. We need to have much more, many more sort of, you know, political, diplomatic conversations with Ukraine. And you're right, they have issues. Obviously you saw what happened yesterday where Zelensky, you know, signed this law and the entire country is now erupting in protest, right? So clearly there is a diplomatic path, you know, a sovereignty path needs to be vetted. It needs to be talked about. But at the same time, we have a war. We have Putin, who is now making 1,000 of these kamikaze Shahed drones, so he can at any point in time send 2,000 of these drones into Ukraine, and he can decimate the country.
Yeah.
And he has no intention of stopping it. I don't think he would stop based on the fact that, oh man, the United States is going to take Ukraine under its wing. I think ultimately, long term, yes, that would have significant impact.
So I'm just telling you, the optics completely change if our message changes to say, you know, if we go in, they have a quick election. They want to be completely away from Russia and become a sovereign state within the United States. And they understand it's going to be a transition. So they'll first be established into a territory status before they can actually start obtaining, you know, some connections to citizenship and those types of things. But bottom line, it puts them on this path. Now we have, optics-wise, now that we have a territory right there in Asia, right? Then now, or Europe, that's on the Europe side of the continent, or the continent. Mm-hmm. So now we actually have the optics of saying, you know, this is now a territory. The people have spoken. The people of the world have spoken, or the people of this state have spoken. They want to be a state in the Union. And so if Putin messes with, I know, now we can unleash the full fury of the United States.
Yeah. So here's a little, I can segue on that. Okay.
Okay. But I don't have time. We need to segue.
Let me tell you about the fury. Okay? This is my main thesis right now in Washington. Okay? In regards to a drone war, We have no fury, GR. We have no fury. We are like, if the Russians are the Dodgers and the Ukrainians are the Yankees, we're a friggin' six-year-old T-ball team. Okay? That's a fact. We have no ability to ship to Ukraine anything in regards to drones. If we get attacked, or if we have to deal with Taiwan and it's a drone war, we are dead in the water. Dead in the water. And there are many congressmen that are saying the same thing. As a matter of fact, Congressman Pat Harrigan questioned one of our generals and said, my understanding is we made 50,000 drones last year in total, and right now they're probably useless in a war like this. We have China and Russia combined getting ready to make 10 million drones a year. So this is the parallel bridge that I'm talking about, that we as a country, if we don't secure Ukraine, whether it's through a sovereignty path or through a military path, if we don't secure Ukraine and Russia consumes Ukraine, not only do they consume that, you know, that country and that democratic state, but they consume all of that technology, all that innovation that's been developed for the past 3.5 years, and it completely eliminates our ability to accelerate our own drone dominance. By the way, President Trump, you applaud him for this. 3 days after Operation Spiderweb in Ukraine, he announced that we're going to be drone dominant. I agree. But guess what? There's a path to become drone dominant. First is secure Ukraine so you weaken Russia, weaken China, and then boom, we can have this happy marriage with Ukraine, and we can bring all this tech to the U.S. so we can fight future wars, right? So I love this conversation, and I think long term, who knows what path it is from a sovereignty perspective, whether they're the 51st state, or whether they, you know, apply something, become a territory. But I think that we have a war problem that we need to deal with right now. And the way we're allocating weapons is completely wrong. It's what Biden was doing. And I do not want to see President Trump make the same mistakes that Biden made. I do not want that to happen.
Okay, so what I'd like to do is bring you back, but we have to actually look at what does it take to get where if we continue to play this status quo warfare,
yeah,
then it's going to cost us a lot of money, and there are other ramifications. If
you know what? We cannot do the status quo. If we keep doing the status
quo. The status quo changes to whatever the convention is. If it's conventional warfare, drone warfare, it doesn't matter. That's the status quo. And that's it. Warfare is a costly business. And we need to get out of this paradigm, because the Constitution doesn't allow us to enjoin with these types of conflicts. If you really think about the Constitution, it did not have, as a matter of fact, the army, the militia and the army, was never to deploy off the United States soil. Never. The Constitution only allowed the deployment of the militia, because our army is the militia, and it only allowed the deployment of the militia for three things: for enforcement of the law, executing the laws, suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasion. All three of those happened within the boundaries of the United States. We were never to be involved in foreign wars or building an empire. And so,
here's the problem we have. Here's the problem we have, GR. We have this guy Putin. Okay, he has zero interest in anything you and I are talking about right now. Zero interest. Maybe down the road that kind of thing would scare him. Doesn't scare him right now. Sanctions don't scare him. Nothing scares him, because he is on a mission. He's on a mission. He will take Ukraine. If we keep doing what we're doing, he'll take Ukraine. He will move into Eastern Europe. He will take Germany. He will take Germany without a problem. And China will take Taiwan. So they will be sitting there.
I'm running out of time. I only have 55 minutes for the show, and I was trying to keep this down to 30, and we're at 42. We need to go. We can come back, but the paradigm is that everybody loses when we fight war. Everybody wins when we fight ideologies and basically move the Constitution forward. And so what I'd like to do is get you to look at the Constitution, what we should be doing and can be doing, because as a citizen, I need to remind people all the time that it is our job, it is a constitutional legal requirement that everybody support that Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. If we have to use deadly force, we're to take up arms to actually do what we can to support the Constitution. So my challenge for you is to look at the Constitution and figure out how to do what you want to do within that Constitution.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
All right. So I'll have you back. I promise I'll have you back. And we'll bring you back in probably in a few weeks, because I've got a lot of content I go through. I know you're probably my number one fan. I'm just kidding. But I go through a lot of content because I want to educate people on that Constitution, because we're so illiterate. But anyway, thank you so much for coming on. And I totally respect what you're doing.
I look forward to chatting again soon.
You know, the fact that you're standing up and you're trying to do something, you're head and shoulders above so many Americans. So God bless you.
DR, if you can show me a path, to stick it in Putin's face, I'm all for it, man.
So work through the state concept. Because if you really think about it, this would put the fear of God in these tyrants, because this unleashes the desires and the innate want of liberty. People do not like living in the statist governments. And I know China's ready to revolt. All these people are ready to revolt. So think about that. When we come back, I'll let the audience know. We'll have you back again, and I'll send you back a little email. But thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, GR. It's been a real pleasure.
You bet. Thank you. Right. Folks, when we come back, we're going to go into a break in just a minute here. So when we come back, I'll try to tie all the ends up of what we're doing with the content currently regarding the land Ponzi scheme and so forth. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. Now, I look forward to having Bill back, but I don't want to harp on that because I want to be consistent, folks. You know me. It is all about do everything we do as citizens of this nation. We are legally obligated to support the Constitution. As a matter of fact, we go through this when we talk about the militia. And so, it is not your fault that we've been indoctrinated incorrectly and operating, and our paradigms are 180 out from what we should be doing as citizens of the greatest nation ever formed. And so, as I teach you, as a U.S. citizen, this is one of the reasons why the oath of a citizen in the United States is legally obligated. This is when they take that oath, they become legally obligated to take up arms and use deadly force if necessary to defend and support the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. So everything we do, has to be supporting that Constitution. If we're actually doing things that are in violation of the Constitution, Bill doesn't know this. And there's so many people. And again, my hat goes off. I've said this before. And when I have the opportunity to interview great people like Bill, my applause. They are standing up and at least they're doing something. Now, as we learn and we realize what we're doing won't take us in the right direction, what do we need to do to go down there? As Christians, we can't force somebody to be saved, right? We can't drag somebody in and into the water, baptize them, and then, watch and control everything they do with shock therapy or whatever we need to compel them so that they never sin. That's not Christ's way. That's antithetical. We all have the responsibility to make our choices. So when a person finally makes a choice to do the right thing, chastising them is not appropriate. At least they're trying to do what in their paradigm, what they understand, they're doing what they think is the right thing to do. This is why we have to academically challenge them, give them the facts, show the source documents, show exactly how and what, we, you know, how this Constitution works, how we're to function as a people and as governments from the county, state, and federal, how we're all supposed to be functioning. We are in this disarray because our education system has brought us here. They've deliberately done this because if you knew what was right, we wouldn't be doing all... I can't say that we wouldn't be doing the wrong thing, but if we were taught properly, it would be so hard to get away with corruption in America, it wouldn't exist. This is why when we go back and we look at what the framers did, and we look at the states, their involvement moving forward, they dropped the ball. The states and our state legislatures dropped the ball. They should have taken the ratification debates, and every time a state joined the union, they would have given them the ratification debates and said, this is how the Constitution has been defined. This is what we have to hold the federal government accountable to. Had everybody had the proper training that, you know, Madison was trying to help them with, this is why we go through the debates in Congress where Madison reads the ratification debates, not the Federalist Papers. Had everybody clung to and had everybody realized in the big picture how important it was to maintain those terms and definitions provided in the ratification debates, we would not even be close to this mess today. As a matter of fact, I believe America would probably still be on the path of enlightenment. But that's okay. It's left for these guys. And the opportunity of being able to not worry about it for years and years and years until the comeuppance comes, because that's where we are today. We're in the comeuppance. We are now paying the price of our forefathers and forefathers and the multiple generations that enjoyed, you know, this unintrusive government. Oh, it just started getting intrusive in the late 1800s. It got a little more intrusive in the early 1900s. Today, they're literally managing and controlling every facet of our lives. They're waging warfare against the states and we the people. Our federal government is actually waging warfare. So, to be clear, folks, we're here to actually get back to the functional architecture of our constitutional governments. If we're not doing that, then the blood is on our hands. This is why I find people like Bill, it's great. He's actually gotten to a point where he's trying to do the right thing. He sees America's interests are critical in going down the path he believes he's going down. But I think differently. And so I'm looking forward to having him back. I'm looking forward and I'm hoping that he takes the time to really examine what we need to be doing and how we need to go down this path of living within our hybrid constitutional republic. So with that, folks, as you know, this is the close of the show. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic and we need your help. God bless.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.